Oh boy, do we have a treat for you today. This is another Hall of Fame podcast from the deep Bald Move archives that we are hauling out for its 35th anniversary. This week, the Princess Bride turns 35. This was an interesting podcast for a couple of reasons. I can't remember why, but it became legendary, the fact that this was a hole in Jim's film catalog collection, and it
An
became a real
intentional
meme.
hole.
It became a real meme in the community that he loved to gloat and say, "I'm never going to watch this. As a matter, you get the least I'm inclined to watch it." And then we backdoored him into the Commission podcast, where he had no choice. He's powerless to pull his contrarian bullshit. This is also like one of those community commissions we used to do, where we had the software that allowed people to buy shares in the community commission. So we had, I don't know, there's like a dozen people on this one. This was a popular podcast. And we came together to make this old crank watch a movie that is essentially Joy caught on celluloid.
Interesting perspective. As social media has become bigger and bigger, I realize that sometimes antagonizing people is a very effective and powerful tool for making money.
Well, it's
Not
a damn
saying
shame
that's
you're
what
not on
happened
social
here,
media then,
but
Jim. I'd hate to do any of that. I hate to have a controversial lightning rod guy getting attention and press and social media. Jeez, that'd be terrible.
I'm not going to say that's what happened, because I wouldn't say that, but it result. Let's just say this: the whole antagonizing thing resulted in $500 in our pockets. So, draw your own
Actually,
conclusions.
I think inflation's taken a bit. Like they were substantially cheaper back in the day. But
They were.
yeah, this was a. It's also like this is like if I remember correctly, a love letter to Andre the Giant and what a cool guy he was. Lots of Andre facts. There's tons of links in the show notes, the original show notes, which I imagine will be preserved. If you want to get into like there's pictures of him, just to sell how massive this guy was, like what the scale he was. And lots of stories from Carrie Elway's As You Wish behind the scenes book that we shared too. So again, happy 35th anniversary for the Princess Bride. This is a classic from our library, originally released March 17th, 2016. It's been too long. Happy anniversary, and hope you enjoy the podcast. Hey everybody, Jim and Aaron back with yet another. I should probably say Aaron and Jim since I'm the first guy talking.
No, it's Jim and Aaron. It's a very specific thing. It's like Laurel and Hardy. Nobody says Hardy and Laurel.
Yeah, I don't know. I gave up first name rights without even thinking about it.
Well,
love those many years ago.
That's how I get you.
It's time to renegotiate.
Yeah,
we're back with another commission podcast. This one on the Princess Bride. Princess Bride is infamous in Bald Move circles for a movie that you flat refused to watch, even though
for 20 years, a good solid 20 years,
you had to make effort to avoid it.
A lot of times, yeah,
because yeah. It was kind of embedded in the fabric of our early going life.
Yeah, right. A lot of my friends would watch this all the time, and I distinctly remember, I've seen probably half this movie just in bits and pieces. And I distinctly remember it being on at many an occasion when we'd be like sitting around playing board games or something. It would be on the background,
yeah.
And everybody would be like, "Oh, the good scene is on. Let's go watch it." And I'd be like, "All right, I guess." And I'd watch a bit of it, and then we go back to gaming.
We were super nerds, by the way.
Yeah,
super giant nerds.
Yeah,
yeah, and just the fact that so, what made this is an existential question? What makes Jim tick? What makes a person decide in the face of all of one's friends and the majority of one's family loving a movie, just be like, dig in, I don't need to see this? What about that is satisfying to you?
Sometimes I derive pleasure from other people's dissatisfaction with me.
Okay.
And so when they say, "Hey, have you seen Princess Bride?" And I say, no, and I probably layer on a thick
little
dab
bit
of like, No, I haven't seen that piece of shit. then they get indignant.
You savor their reaction?
I do. I savor their tears a little bit. Yeah.
That might be sociopathic behavior. I don't know.
Yeah, but I limit myself to fairly trivial sociopathy.
Okay. Well, thank God for that. So I just want to give a quick shout out to the people that made this happen. We had a bunch. This was a popular, one of the first things got voted to the community commissions, which if you don't know, there's two ways you commission a podcast. One, you just pay for the whole thing yourself. The other way is you talk a bunch of people into going in $10 a share and right. Get enough of those sold. And then we do it that way too. But we had a large and diverse number of people coming together to commission this thing. We had Zan from Melbourne, Australia, Barry C. from the UK. It's the Coalition of the Willing. Allison Wilde, Robot K, Brian S., John H., Stefan G., Mark S., Denise T., Leslie W., J.R., not Ewing, just J, and then the letter R.
Okay.
Ryan L., S. Duncan, Joffrey B., I can only assume it's Baratheon, Pimonet, and Weezer West. These were the last two usernames I couldn't really extract any kind of proper name from. But your contribution is appreciated. I was nervous, excited to watch this because, we watched it together, and the whole time I'm like, if Jim just hates this, this is going to be a shit show of a podcast. Before we start...
It literally took... It's funny because I would have gone to my grave having never seen Princess Bride.
Yeah, no, I know
if it wasn't
about
for
you.
The community here. Yeah. So, I mean, you'd have to Clockwork Orange me to get me to watch it. Or, have me start a podcasting thing 5, 10 years ago.
It was a long con.
It was the long con by the listeners, and they finally got me.
I kind of think that I think we are all guilty of a little bit of psychopathy because there was an undue amount of glee and delight when
sociopathy or sociopathy?
I don't know.
I get those confused. I think I said it wrong earlier.
I'm never going to be one to correct your pronunciation on anything.
Okay, why are we psychopaths?
Because everyone was just delighted that they were bringing you down.
They were.
It's like, I don't know if that's right. Its own brand of insanity to bring down someone that's insane, but...
I think one begets the other, right? Like, you see a guy acting irrationally and like an asshole, and you want to bring him down any way you can. And by forcing him to engage in the thing that he refuses to engage in, I think they win.
All right. Some solid psychology here. Barry C. wanted to know up front how much, he said, given all the pop culture references this movie has spawned, how much of this film was a surprise and how much did you feel was kind of new, percentage-wise?
I think it was about half. Somewhere between like 40 and 50% was stuff I had seen.
So I don't want to dig into them now, but I kind of want to know to better, because this is going to be largely me interviewing you about your experience watching this film. I want to know... What was the kind of new? What are the things that you felt like you had a good handle on? Like the icon. What were the scenes that you kind of already had seen?
Right. So I definitely had seen all of that Iocane powder scene.
Okay.
The poison scene.
The Battle of the Wits.
Yes, I definitely seen all of that. I had seen a good portion of the first the sword fight that Inigo Montoya and Wesley get into.
Okay. Because I thought maybe that had taken you by surprise a bit.
No. So I didn't see a lot leading up to that. I didn't see them climbing the thing except for the very end of it. Like, I remember him kind of being stuck on the side.
Sure.
And then him getting up there and sword fighting.
Yeah.
Didn't see a good chunk after that. I had seen... I had gotten glimpses of the Billy Crystal stuff, but not that whole scene.
Uh-huh.
There were a couple of other big, big moments that I had seen before.
What do you think was the biggest, I guess, surprise of the movie?
Honestly, I think the fire swamps, the rats in the fire swamps.
Oh, so you had no idea that whole sequence is in there?
No idea.
It's kind of like it veers into Dark Crystal Labyrinth territory.
Yeah, it's surprisingly good.
Okay.
It's funny. You get a sense of fear. Like, the monsters are kind of scary, the way that they put people in costumes and they're skittering around and ugh.
Sure. So the other pre-feedback I want to get to, then we got some more at the that we're going to close with, is something from Zan, where she's saying, where I don't know if it's a, I'm assuming Zan is a woman, but there again, it's like, I could see Zan could be masculine as well.
Yeah, sure.
It's a Star Trek name. It's like a it's some kind of Australian only. I'm not familiar with Zans running around. A Xander? Would that be a Xander?
Yeah, maybe. Okay. The only Xander I know is from Buffy.
But it's not X-A-N, it's Z-A-N. That's right. Anyway, they were hoping that you could sit back and forget what you thought you knew about the movie and just enjoy it. Fingers crossed that you will be pleasantly surprised and wonder why you've delayed the experience for so long.
No.
So,
I mean, that didn't happen.
So, just upper... What would you give this movie after sober analysis? What would you what would this rating be?
I give it a thumbs up.
Okay.
But
do you understand why people love the movie?
Yeah, absolutely. There are some truly iconic things about it. I just like having seen these big important parts of it already, it didn't quite hit me as a whole the way it should have. And the way I think it hit a lot of people. Because, you know, all my friends run around quoting Inconceivable and I'm like,
right.
Okay, well, he's saying that again, and all my friends quote that, and that's a thing in this movie, and it just didn't work on the same level.
Sure.
You know?
Okay, so you're genuinely positive about it. And we can probably talk about some things we didn't like as we go, because I'm going to kind of take this chronologically, just parts of the movie you want to talk about. First up, were you aware of the conceit of the movie being a story within a story? A dweem within a dweem, if you will.
I don't think I remember Fred Savage
Peter Falk.
Yeah.
What do you think? So, does the conceit of the grandfather coming and reading this story to his largely unwilling grandson, which one sharp listener drew a nice analogy with us and you in this situation? Do you think that added to the movie, detracted to the movie? Or was neutral to the movie? Like, if you take that part out, does
it
play?
I like it. I think it works better because, like, then you get the very distinct storybook feel, right? Like, fairy tale sort of thing. Whereas that's definitely what the story reads as.
Yeah.
And without that part where, oh, they're actually reading this story, it would feel a little bit like, okay, why is Wesley here? Like, why is he sticking around this horrible family? It treats him like shit.
Right.
Like, all these questions just kind of evaporate in the face of, hey, it's a fairy tale, it's a storybook. And that's, you know, obvious in the movie.
I think, it's kind of disarming because there are some patently ridiculous things that the movie's like, this is a kid's story, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
And it also breaks up some of the tension, I think, because, like, I know from experience with my son that there are some things that are genuinely terrifying for the 5 to 8 year old.
Kissing.
That's one of them.
One of them, yeah.
The swamp rats. Like, I remember the first time I sat down to watch this movie with my son, he shit his pants when those R.O.U.S.s came out and just went to town on Wesley.
Yeah.
He didn't, and I thought he would maybe nope at, because I remember I had a problem with the torture scenes.
Right.
Because I've just never seen a person harmed for sport before. And even though the machine is ridiculous, they don't play like it is. Like, it seems like this guy is genuinely being destroyed. And I was
50 years of his life.
I was really uncomfortable with that, but no, we didn't even get it out of the fire swamp.
Yeah.
I also like it because it plays kind of homage to the source material, which is a novel written by William Goldman, but it propounds kind of in the same way that J.R.R. Tolkien said that The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings were books that he found and translated from earlier legit sources.
Like a Joseph Smith sort of thing.
This was like an abridged copy of the Princess Bride by some S. Morgenstern who doesn't exist.
Okay.
And like, you know, that kind of story within a story aspect is in there too. But you're right. I think it also adds... What'd you say? Touching?
Yeah. I think there's something touching about this grandfather reading to his child and how the child is just like, fuck books. I don't care about your stupid story,
games,
Dad.
Grandpa.
I'm playing an Atari. I'm playing a Nintendo.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good... It's also a lens for the adult to get into it, right? Mm-hmm. And kind of hit you in the feels a little bit.
I think if you're a guy my age, the vintage toys...
Oh, man.
Like, this is, like, all that stuff. Like, I think he's playing a baseball game on a Commodore 64, which I had. He's got all the Star Wars toys behind him. You know, it's... he's living in, like, an idealized 8-year-old world from the 80s.
Sure.
Which I really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Robin Wright.
Let's, yeah.
Robin Wright is some ethereal creature.
Yeah, it's incredible.
She was born gorgeous. She's like 50 years old now. She's still dropped
dead
gorgeous.
Does she look any different? I mean,
no, she's definitely. I would say that Buttercup, the Buttercup era, Robin Wright is a much warmer creature,
a little softer.
Whereas
a little,
she's now
yeah.
kind of like a frozen marble statue.
Right.
An ice queen.
But she is really just frozen in time. Like,
that's also might be because I've only seen her as like the distant housewife of Bruce Willis in Unbreakable and, right. you know, Claire Underwood. And so I don't know anything about the person,
uh-huh.
but she's still beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, think she looks as good now as the day Princess Bride was filmed.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, Carrie, how do you pronounce this guy's name? Is it Elois?
Man, that's one for the ages. I have
Carrie
no yeah,
who also contributed to making this podcast by making the movie.
Yep.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. And now, back with more Bald Move.
I know watching the director, Rob Reiner, his commentary, I've seen it several times on The Princess Bride. And he just, like, every time the place in the director's commentary gets, he just, like, I can't believe I got these two beautiful people.
Right.
Like, I could have put them and they could have done anything and this movie would have been a hit because, like, yeah. they're almost so beautiful. It physically is painful.
They really are just, like, storybook beautiful.
Yeah.
Just, like, what you think of as princess and hero. Like,
right.
Classic looks.
But Carrie is... Wesley is also got, I mean, he's not just a pretty boy. I mean, he definitely is, but he's also believable as this swashbuckling heroic figure that could best the best swordsman in the world and outfight a giant and outthink this Vizzini character.
Yeah, it definitely helps that I had seen him in Robin Hood Men in Tights before this. Like, I like him in everything he does. He's really good in Liar Liar even. That's, you know, kind of a very different thing. But Robin Hood Men in Tights is where he's essentially playing a very similar character, right? So, like, I knew he could do this thing, and so seeing him do it wasn't that surprising for me.
Well, see, I had the opposite experience. I knew him from Princess right. Bride, and then when I heard he was, you know, cast in a farcical version of Robin Hood, it was largely a reaction to the ludicrous Kevin Costner one, which I just saw within, like, the last 2 months.
Uh-huh.
I was like, oh my God. I was actually disappointed in the final movie.
Like, because, oh my God, he's perfect?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, right. oh my God, Mel Brooks is making a Robin Hood send up and he cast this guy.
That's the thing. This movie kind of feels like a Mel Brooks joint in some ways.
So I usually don't like tonal shifts, and I don't know why I give this movie a pass, because there's moments where, you know, you are genuinely concerned for the heroes. There mm-hmm. are moments where there's actually some tension and romance and high drama, but then they also go to, like, Billy Crystal comes on and it right. turns into a Mel Brooks comedy.
Yeah, or they bonk people on the head and knock them out.
it's very PG-rated Mel uh-huh. Brooks, but yeah. No, I don't know why it can kind of run roughshod over all that.
I know, I was surprised to see that it wasn't a Mel Brooks film. It's actually directed by Rob Reiner, which
yeah, who's also got, you know, a lot of different gears and things that he can do. I mean, he's done this. He's done this as Spinal Tap, which I guess is kind of in a similar vein. But what's the stuff that I'm trying to? I've drawn a blank on the things that I know that he's kind of like. Stand By Me.
I don't think I've seen that.
That's the one with Will Wheaton and right. It's a Stephen King novel.
I don't think I've seen that.
When Harry Met Sally.
I definitely haven't seen
Misery.
That. I've seen that.
Like
I didn't
few
know
good
he
men,
did that. Holy shit!
A Few Good Men.
Right.
So he's got a lot of different gears. Hmm. Unfortunately, I feel like his gears completely, you know, got ground off after A Few Good Men because I don't think I've as I'm going through his filmography, it kind of falls off a cliff there. But anyway, you still did Princess Bride. You're All Right by Me.
There's a lot of stuff in here, too, and I think maybe this lends itself to feeling like a Mel Brooks film, is mm-hmm. A lot of cheesy stuff in here, mm-hmm. right? There's, like, when they're climbing up the rock face and they're on this rope and they're just obviously being hoisted by a crane, completely, you can tell. There's just a lot of cheesy effects, a lot of cheesy lines, a lot of cheese. I mean, even the film stock they use is very of the time.
Yeah.
And obviously low quality, you know?
You should also, if you get a chance, go on YouTube and watch the original trailer, theatrical trailer.
Oh, I bet that's a hot mess.
It is. I mean, trailers have just become like these works of art in their own right, but it's just, I don't know why anyone would see this movie if they release a trailer. And I think, I feel like Rob Reiner was kind of pissed at the way they marketed this movie. And he didn't feel like they did it. Now, fortunately, it became a cult classic and is kind of beloved by all. But you're right. Yeah. There's like their prop boat is especially shitty.
Yeah.
It's like high school production level what a boat needs to be able to do. And
you're right. That was pretty bad.
There's also a lot of things like I've gotten from behind the scene notes, like Cary Elwes's book and Rob Reiner's commentary that like Andre the Giant was a wreck of a human being at this point in his career.
Yeah.
His back was, he was in constant pain. He was in very poor health. Anytime you see him carrying Wesley or Buttercup, he's wearing elaborate braces and counter, because he couldn't carry Robin Wright, who probably weighs 105.
Yeah.
Soaking wet.
And this is a guy who body slams 250-pound men in the ring,
sure,
or had sure. over the course of
well,
his
that's
career.
One of the, I mean, first of all, he has a condition called like gigantomorphism,
right?
It's whatever it is.
It
caused him to grow enormous. Like, and that's the thing. Like, this isn't a special effect. This isn't Hobbit shit. He's just twice as big as everybody. Mm-hmm. There's also, I'm going to include some of this in the show notes because they tickle me. There's a picture of Andre the Giant holding a 12-ounce beer can, and it looks like, I mean, not even an 8-ounce Red Bull. It looks like like some kind of kid prop thing.
All right, I want you to guess his height and weight.
I think he's 7'5" and 450 pounds.
Oof, you are close on the height. 7'4".
Okay. Because I've done some research on the Giant.
Apparently,
he's my
you
favorite.
Have.
Like, I'm not even into wrestling, but I am a legit Andre the Giant fan.
520 pounds.
At what point? Because that's the other thing.
Build weight. I don't know.
You go research, because this guy's a Frenchman. You go and research when he first started, like, joined the circus. He's 18. He was actually a really good looking. Like, there's pictures of him, like, holding up, like, a ridiculous amount of women on his. Like, he's, like, cut. Like, this, like, super heroic figure.
There is an incredible picture of Andre the Giant,
Arnold
Schwarzenegger, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar,
No, it's Wilt Chamberlain.
Wilt Chamberlain?
Maybe?
Okay, it's one of the really ridiculously tall basketball players. Yeah. Incredible photo.
From
it's
Conan,
just, like,
from
the specimens of physicality.
Yeah. Except for Arnold looks like a little person.
Yeah, no,
he's just dangling between the two guys.
He's standing between a couple of 7-foot-plus guys.
Yeah.
I mean,
But yeah, I mean, that's...
Yeah, aren't they picking him up? Don't they lift
him
up? I think
so. They're picking him up, and he's kind of swinging between them.
And flexing, you know, as Arnold does.
But Andre just seems like such a good guy. Like, everyone says nothing but positive things about his work ethic and about him being nice as a person. And I guess he was in constant pain, and he would drink heroic amounts to deal with it. Like,
wow.
2 cases of beer a day. Which sounds like a lot, but like he would drink a pint like we would drink a 5-gallon bucket, you know, proportionate to his size and weight.
Other way around.
Oh, well, yeah. His pint glass would be like a 5-gallon bucket of beer.
Okay.
But he would drink just like 50 cans of beer.
That's insane. I mean, that couldn't have helped his problems, right?
Well, no. But again, I mean
is
this
it better
guy was,
or worse than Vicodin?
This guy was destined to live a short life.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, most people that live with these conditions don't make it out of their late 30s, mid 40s. I think he got to 49.
46.
46?
46, apparently.
And I think he died kind of penniless, too.
Yeah.
If I'm recalling correctly.
Doesn't surprise me. I don't know.
I mean, the wrestling...
That's a rough life.
Like, if you've seen The Wrestler...
Right.
Imagine going through that, except for you also have some genetic conditions that give you persistent health problems and...
Yeah.
...make buying clothes and everything else difficult. But yeah, I think he's amazing, especially... He still conveys this size and strength, even though he's physically decrepit.
Yeah. The other thing about this movie, though, I will say, yes, a lot of it looks cheesy, but some of it looks... actually pretty good. Like, I was talking about the rat costumes that they use in the swamp or the forest, whatever it is. What is that called?
Fire swamp,
but it looks kind of like a forest to me. It looks like Dagobah, actually.
Yeah.
It looks exactly like Dagobah.
I mean, because I had, when we were watching this and we were talking about it, I had the ink, something tickling in the back of my head that this might have been filmed in the same studio. Like the same studio they filmed Star Wars on, which then led me to go, I wonder, like, if maybe some of this was some of the Dagobah set that's been reused. But I couldn't substantiate any of that.
It looks a lot like it. Mm-hmm. But I think that stuff is all done pretty well. The castle set, I think, is done really well.
Sure.
I think it's a set. I don't think it's a real castle. It looks like a set to me.
I was,
because it doesn't have the dimensionality to it. It doesn't have, like, that 3D look.
They did a really good job of weathering, and like, there were certain aspects of, like, the windows that I thought looked real, but I don't know. What'd you think of the sword fight? That's, like, one of the...
Man, I was fucking impressed.
I was worried that you would think it looked very stagey.
Fuck no.
Okay.
I mean, it's not... Typically, sword fights don't go on and on like that. You get one guy, and they're a lot slower, like... Mm-hmm. There will be bursts of action versus this sustained sort of thing. But I thought, just sheerly from nailing the choreography, those guys hit it out of the park. I mean, they go like left-handed and right-handed. And, you know, that's the gag there. But I was super fucking impressed with the whole thing.
I got, because, you know, Carey wrote this book, As You Wish, where he just told, like, it was around the 25th anniversary of the movie. And he did, like, a tell-all. Well, it wasn't much, like, bad. It was just all, like, how great of an experience it was. And he just went into detail. And I haven't read the book. Someone asked me if I had. I want to. I especially want to hear the audiobook, because I guess he does a really killer impersonations of a lot of the people in the movie.
Like Andre?
Yeah. Notably, he does a good Andre, which isn't hard to do. You just kind of talk real low and screw everything. But he mentioned that they trained for, like, months.
I bet.
Olympic fencers to get all this detail down. And the scene is supposed to be this, like, 4 or 5 minutes. Like, Rob Reiner says, this has got to be, like, the greatest sword fight that we've seen in film to date. And it might have been.
It's pretty close.
Like, I know there's been better sword fights probably since, arguably different. Like, there's shit in The Matrix. Yeah. There's shit in Wire Fu movies. You know, Rob Roy has got a pretty different, impressive sword fight. But they did it all out, and they got so good... him and Mandy Patinkin, that they actually did the 4-minute fight in like a minute 30 when they actually showed up to film it that day. So they went back and refactored it. And I guess originally that, like, doing all that, you know, swinging off of the tower and, like, they added a lot of embellishments to make it more impressive and to kind of slow it down.
Wow. Wow. I was shocked at how good that was.
And, like, I don't understand why some of the lines work as well as they do. Like, when Inigo is, first of all, I think that, like, you know, their whole interaction on the cliff
yep.
works really well. Like, they have, like, this insane chemistry. And then in the middle of sword fight, he's like, please tell me. I must know who you are. He's like, get used to disappointment. And Mandy's delivery of, like, okay. Well, this is my life now, is so hilarious. It gets me every fucking time.
Yeah, that was a really good one. that's the trouble with it, though. Like, I had seen all this stuff from The Princess Bride, and so the parts that really should have hit me, like, they didn't in quite the same way because I knew I was coming. But that one, I didn't remember where he's like, get used to disappointment. He just responds, okay.
Yeah, it's just like, okay.
Like, no quippy sort of thing, just okay.
But it's the delivery that makes it work. What do you think about the test of strength? Again, like, I mean, it's just funny for Andre to explain. I don't know. The scenes is funny.
Is the test of strength where he grabs him from behind and chokes him out?
Starts choking him out. And the whole reason he's like talking about what it's like to fight as a giant, and as he's passing out, he's still giving commentary. It cracks me up every time.
Why do you think that is? Do you think he thinks he can't be beat, even as he's in the process of being beat? Or is he just too dumb?
I mean, this guy's just such a gentle soul. He's like, but it's hard to figure him out because at the one hand,
he's real dumb.
I think he's willing to beat Wesley's brains out with a rock if he's not going to put down the sword because he's not going to die.
Sure.
But he's kind of strangely apologetic about the whole thing. I don't know how to analyze the comedy of it, but there's something hilarious about them having this genteel conversation. Wow, yeah. Andre's like, and it looks painful every time he slams him against that rock.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's 520 pounds of meat smashing you
against
that rock.
Even if he's just stunt slamming against a styrofoam rock, that's still gotta be something. Again, and also just a physical comedy of how huge Andre is versus Wesley.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Do you want to talk about the Battle of Wits? This is one of, I think, for first blush, one of the funnier moments of the film, just because what's this guy's name? Wallace? I can't remember the guy's name, but he plays the Grand Nagus in Star Trek The Next Generation, which you had a hard time overlooking.
Because he acts exactly like the Grand
character.
Nagus.
He
has the same voice, the same mannerisms, everything. I want to say it's Wallace Scott Shawn or something like that.
It might be Wallace Shawn.
Something like that. Every time I see him, I think of the Grand Nagus from Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
But he's got some of the funniest lines, the whole, like, you know, when he's like, just how smart are you? And he's like, have you ever heard of Plato, Socrates, Aristotle? Morons.
Right.
And some of the stuff he says, like, and that... I know the people of Australia have gotten the wrong idea about me and how I view the unwashed criminal continent of Australia, but 99% of the reason I make that joke is because of his line where he's like, and as everyone knows, Australia is entirely peopled with criminals. It's hilarious. Like, what? Yeah. No, it's also like, what fucking time in history is this movie set in? Because in the Renaissance or before, no one knew where the hell Australia was.
Right. But if it's set in a modern setting where they would know Australia, they wouldn't be roaming around doing the things they're doing.
But it somehow works because the book that this based on is kind of a spoof of the fairy tale, but also has a lot of what I would call what do you call it with this? What is a political commentary? It's not a spoof. It's a satire. It's a farce. Huh.
Okay.
So it's got a lot of those anachronisms in it as well. And I just think that's funny that he's got, you know, iocane powder comes from Australia, which shouldn't exist, and blah blah blah.
And it makes sense given that this is literally a book that this grandpa's reading to his child.
Yeah.
So. It doesn't matter if there are inconsistencies in the story because that's just in the book.
Sure. Can we talk about, so at this whole time, this guy's purporting to be this man in black and he's trying to, we don't know why, but he's trying to keep he's trying to go after this princess, Buttercup.
I mean, we do know why, right?
Well,
we know
that
the man
this,
in black
point,
is really Wesley.
Yeah, that's right, because we as the audience know this is Wesley.
Yeah, there's it's a Clark Kent situation.
It is.
There's no debating who that is.
What is his game?
When he finally catches up with her? And
someone donated to us a copies of this a book called about the Princess Bride and philosophy.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because there's a lot of professors of philosophy and... you know, digging into things like, you know, what is the nature of a promise? What's the nature of a lie? You know, the issues of trust. And they talk about a little bit of this. I've read about half the book. I haven't read the whole thing. But one of the things they talk about is kind of like, you know, what exactly is Wesley trying to get at here? Did you have any read on this?
I don't know why he's pretending not to be Wesley. I get that there's some anger and there's some confusion there.
He went off, so they pledged themselves to each other.
Yeah.
He went off to make his fortune because...
So he could marry her.
So he can marry, so he can pay the dowry price or whatever bullshit patriarchal things going on here. He gets kidnapped by a pirate and presumed dead. Yep. And then, meanwhile, for a political stunt, the prince decides to marry a commoner. And he's also got this whole, like, there's this also this other subplot about... You know, trying to start wars between nations and a false flag operation. That's
right.
Kind of like, you know, no 6-year-old is getting all this into thing. But I feel like that he doesn't know for sure whether she's rejected him or not. Whether it's like, you know, it's like, is she a gold digger or did she, you know, on the other hand, if she thought she's dead, like to me, that's it.
Right.
Like that's, you know, if you think someone's dead, this is how I came down with the Shane and Lori thing. With The Walking Dead. If someone's dead, then if you really sincerely believe someone's dead, then the marriage is over.
Sure.
Or the engagement.
I get that. And it seems like...
And if you can't ever love again, then why not go for fame and riches, I guess.
Yeah. No, there's definitely anger there on Wesley's part. That
but
she,
they also make
that
it...
she would not... That she would just, you know, get married to some other guy when he's been gone, what, 3 years, I think?
If I'm not even five...
Five at some point. Okay,
it's a long time.
It was, yeah. But it's just like I don't know. She has confusion about what actually happened to him.
Sure,
he has anger because I'm not sure he understands what she knows or what she thinks she knows.
Yeah,
like does he know that she thought he was dead?
Yeah,
or not? Because they don't really talk about that, right?
But it seems
he just
like he
falls
goes,
down,
he,
and
seems like he plays this game way past the point of where a reasonable person would be like, okay, my darling.
Reveal yourself and see what happens and maybe talk some of this shit out instead of just being angry at each other.
I guess that's kind of interesting that he doesn't feel like he can trust her.
Yeah.
Like, if he reveals himself, she might say some false bullshit.
I mean, yeah.
He has to be sure.
If she just decided that she didn't want him and she wanted to marry this prince or whatever, this king, Prince Humperdinck. Yeah. Then maybe he reveals himself and she's like, psh, whatever, man, I'm getting married.
Yeah.
Fuck off.
Yeah. Or I guess you could imply a pseudo noble intent that if she genuinely did love the prince and want to marry him, maybe he doesn't want to interfere with that. He wants to rescue her. Sure. From whatever's happening here. There's also like, if you think about the timing of the situation, like how the fuck,
what do you mean?
Did the Dread Pirate Roberts get wind of this plot and happen to, like, why is he just now, like, I guess he just, the way I think the chronology worked is he just recently got control of the Revenge, the pirate ship.
Okay.
At the same time that Buttercup was to be married, at the same time this guy's going to have her killed to frame the nation of Gilder into going into war with Florin. You know what I mean? Like, that's very...
Well, they do well to pick up kind of just right in the middle of that.
That's
right?
True.
Like,
and also,
she's basically
also,
on the boat.
So don't sweat it too much.
Right, right.
Yeah. What do you think of this? The other thing I thought was really impressive is the stunt tumbling that these.
Oh, God.
And it's kind of funny because she just trips and, like, she shoves him down and he's having a bad time of it, but she just kind of trips and then tumbles.
After she realizes that it's Wesley, yeah.
And I wonder, because I've seen this in many movies since, like, almost the parody of falling down a cliff. And then I've seen some playing it straight, like that Lone Survivor movie about the Navy SEAL. Holy shit, I guess that happened in real life. That
I haven't seen that. Is that the Bradley Cooper one?
No, that's American Sniper. This is the one about Marcus Luttrell, I think is his name. And it's a four Navy SEALs go to Afghanistan on a recon mission, and they end up getting into a world of shit.
Huh.
But there's one point where, I guess this happened in real life, they all four of them, they're at a cliff, essentially, and they got, like, 20 guys with assault rifles coming at them, and they're like, well, we can either die here or take our ch-, and they decided to hurl themselves off this cliff. And it feels like it's lasting for a minute, these guys falling down this rocky cliff.
Jesus.
Breaking legs and backs, and it's fucking insane.
They needed a pouch full of stones, then they couldn't cut the rope and send them to their death.
You know, the thing that's funny about the stunt tumbling, though, is the Buttercup is clearly a man.
Right. That stunt double is,
might even have
a bad wig.
Might even have a beard.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of like...
It might be Rob Reiner.
Very slim Rob Reiner.
Uh-huh. I imagine he was slim back in the late 80s.
Did you get that... So we go on to the Fire Swamp, which I think the Fire Swamp is pretty incredible.
I liked it.
The quicksand effect,
lightning
sand, is really good. Like, I'm not even sure how you do something to where you can dive into what apparently is solid sand and smoothly go through it and not break your, you know. Like, I've got some ideas of how it can happen, but the reason the sand doesn't, like, fall in, like, it doesn't make a hole.
Yeah. I imagine you could have some kind of, like, imagine if you took, like, rubber, like a balloon or something, right? You stretched out over that hole and you put, like, a hole in the center of it, to where when somebody dove through it,
it would expand
right, like, and constrict around their body so the sand doesn't go down.
Yeah.
And then it would snap back once they're through it. Maybe something like that.
Okay.
And then they just dive through and there's a literal pool underneath that they go into, or...
Because I'm thinking, like, if...
Because he dives head first in.
Yeah, like, if that's any kind of padding, I think you'd break your neck.
That would be no good.
Of course, I guess stuntmen do kinds of crazy shit all the time.
That's true.
But no, it looked great. Looked great when they're pulled out. I'm actually a big fan of the rodents of unusual sizes.
Yes,
I will tell you that it was only the first time I watched this with my son that I got that ROUSs was actually an acronym.
When did they say that?
That she calls them the, you know, he's like RO. She says, "What are the ROUSs?" And he goes, "Rodents of unusual size. I don't think they exist." I thought that the ROUSs was like some kind of weird language, like, you know, some kind of French term for these rats that was translated as rodents of unusual size.
I mean, that's what okay.
That's what I said. I didn't I heard language, not letters. And like for 20 years, I didn't get that.
ROUS.
Gag.
So like A-R...
Like R-O... Like Atreyu.
O-U-S-E or something.
Like if someone says the name Atreyu, that could be, you know, like a license plate type of deal.
Right.
Or it could be the guy's name. I thought ROUS
That shocks me. How many times have you seen this?
Dude,
how
recently? I'm not proud of it. I'm not proud of it.
Okay.
It's like the Natalie Merchant song. I thought instead of the way I feel under your command, I thought for many, many years... I mean, I didn't literally think this because it's ridiculous, but I couldn't piece out what she's saying, so I just sang the way I feel I'm the Orkin man. And then, you know, genius.com came out, and I'm like, oh, of course. All right.
Almost led you down a path of extermination as a career.
I think the ROUSs are pretty, like, they're really solid effect. Like, the only thing that gives them away is that their rear legs don't bend right.
But I feel like that also gives them, like, a creepy sort of skittering, scuttling quality to them.
Yeah, and it must have been hell to be the stuntman doing that. Yeah. Because, like, it's, like, do bear crawls, you know, where you're walking on your hand and feet and as fast as you can. That's murder.
But those are effectively freaky and
super gory,
nasty.
Too. Like, he gets his shoulder fucked up.
Uh-huh.
Did you think... The other thing I had an idle curiosity and didn't research is it sounds like the ROUSs are voiced by Frank Oz.
It really does.
Grover from Sesame Street and Yoda fame.
Yeah. No, I thought so, too.
Okay, so they get out of the fire swamp, and, you know, one thing leads to another. Buttercup sacrifices her happiness to save Wesley's life when the prince catches up to them. And he hasn't taken to the pit of despair.
Yeah.
Which then it goes into total Mel Brooks mode. Like, you literally have this crazy albino,
I mean, straight out of Robin Hood
hunchback thing. And, well, except for this came before it, and he's got the raspy hunchback voice, and then he clears his throat and he's got this very melodious. I mean, that's just, the broadest of broad comedy.
Yeah.
No, did it work for you?
Yeah, why not?
Okay.
I don't know. Mel Brooks type stuff is touch and go for me, but
I want to talk about one thing that doesn't work emphatically for me, and that is this movie's soundtrack. This movie's soundtrack might have been okay when it was made, but the 80s synth, it really could have used a full orchestra score, I think.
Yeah, I'm trying to even remember it. It was just forgettable for me. I didn't.
Yeah, and it also does like weird things, like I feel like in a sword fight, it did almost like, you know, some Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey kind of drum rolls and like comedic beats that I think would have been better if they played it straight.
Okay,
but that's the and I think that the soundtrack when it gets these Mel Brooks moments really goes into that high gear when I think it could have probably been more subtle and played more straight and been even funnier.
All right.
I also want to talk about the scene between Count Rogan and Prince Humperdinck when they're discussing whether Humperdinck is going to witness Wesley's first torture.
Okay.
And there's like this 2-minute scene of the bad guys in the movie talking like just regular, like, oh, you know, I'm so swamped. I got all these things. And Count Rogan's like, well, if you haven't got your health, you know, you have to take care of yourself. If you haven't got your health, what have you?
Right.
What the fuck is this scene doing in this movie?
I don't know. It's not funny. Does it make him relatable?
I mean, it's funny in a very meta way.
It's
of like
funny
why...
in how mundane it is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, these are supervillains. These are evil men. They
it's
should
banal.
Be
it's...
concocting plots and I don't know.
I mean, I guess it's a stab at, like, Hitler had a dog too moment. Like,
right.
You know, these people, like, these guys are bros. They genuinely can... But they're evil, but they care about each other.
I can't tell if that's supposed to read like that, if we're supposed to feel some attachment or at least understanding of these guys through those moments, or if that is literally there just to be a laugh because look at how, you know, just pointless this conversation is with these people who are plotting evil plans. I don't know.
What did you think of the life-sucking machine? Very steampunk medieval torture device.
Yeah. No, I mean, what did I think of it? I mean, it's a fairy tale book, so I wasn't like, oh, that could never work. You could never suck away someone's life.
It terrified me as a child. There's something very cold and I don't know. I still feel like it's just, anytime, you know, you read stuff about like what the Nazis got up to, and anytime you just have like the cold application of science and medicine towards the suffering of humanity. That's some, I mean, like any kind of torture thing, I guess, is like, God, someone thought about this thing and then built it and then used it on people.
Yeah. Yeah. And practiced. It's disturbing.
Yeah. I don't know. Okay. Well, that's going nowhere.
I mean, the machine itself, I don't like
it. I think it's a cool concept, though.
It is. Yeah. It's different. It's different than like we're just going to cause you some pain here.
And it's great because this is like this is a soft PG, not 13 rated movie. It's a great way to get into a medieval torture scene without offending anyone's sensibilities. And yet, I still think it's horrifying.
No blood
for children. Yeah,
I mean the idea of sucking away years of your life is also horrifying in and of itself.
Yeah, the fact that it's like whatever, and I never like knew whether it's this the experience of the pain.
Yeah.
Takes years off your life, or it's literally sucking some kind of ineffable life force.
When, so like, let's say Wesley was destined to die when he was like 40,
mm-hmm.
and they crank it up to 50 years, life sucking. What happens to him? He just dies, right?
I mean,
just
that's what, on I mean, the... like, he's so, approximately 20 years old, and they did crank it up to max.
Can we infer that he wouldn't have lived past 70?
That's a good question.
Or was it just too much? Is sucking that much life out of someone just too
much
all at once?
Yeah, that much vitality, probably. And the other thing is, like, Rogan had never done more than 3 or the 5. So, like, who knows whether the scale doesn't go logarithmic. It could have been sucked 1,000 years off his life. He just doesn't. How would he know? It's just an experiment to him.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk about Billy Crystal.
Okay.
Because I'm not a big Billy Crystal fan.
I am not either.
But for some reason, this Miracle Max shit... this vaudeville shit works for me.
This is his shtick. I mean, if you don't like this, you're not going to like Billy Crystal.
I don't like Billy Crystal. I like this.
Which is super surprising because I feel the same way.
I think he, I mean, because I also, I remember liking City Slickers a lot as a kid too.
Okay.
And I've seen him like on Oscar, you know, be very charming and kind of in his lane in the Oscar stuff. And it, you know, when he hosts an Oscar, it's pretty funny.
Yeah.
But the story, I guess that he was on the set for like 3 or 4 days. He's in Miracle Max Get Up for 10 hours. And the story goes that the man never repeated a line twice. He just ad-libbed everything. And Rob Reiner had to leave the set because his horse laughing was interfering with every take. He just like, and there's,
yeah,
again, like, this gets me every fucking time where he's like, come on, go away, I'll call the Brute Squad. And Andre's like, I'm in the Brute Squad. And he's like, you are the Brute Squad. Like, the timing on that,
it's and perfect.
His take on it is so goddamn funny. I laugh. There's a couple points in Young Frankenstein, like the putting on the Ritz scene in Young Frankenstein. I brace myself and I get ready for it, and every time I'm in tears laughing.
Yeah.
It's just, there's some things you can't prepare for. Like, absolutely. The fucking Iron Giant, same way. Like, my girlfriend put that on this weekend. She goes, isn't this the movie you always cry on?
And,
like,
and you were already crying.
No, halfway through the movie, I was anticipating the end. I'm like, nope, fuck it. No, get this off. I got to go to a birthday party. You do not want me after Iron Giant going to this damn birthday party.
Right.
But nah, he's, I
Billy
don't
Crystal,
know.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Billy Crystal in general. I liked him in this. I also,
even the MLT mutton, lettuce, and tomato, that shouldn't be funny, but it fucking cracks me up.
I really like his, he does this stage show, which it's an autobiography sort
it's
of deal.
It's a one-man thing, yeah.
Yeah, it's called 700 Sundays. I watched it when it first came out, just kind of as, I don't know, just something to do, because I don't really like Billy Crystal. But it turned out to be really good. Like, really? I was super impressed by that.
I avoided that because it was Billy Crystal as a one-man show, and I feel like it's just, Billy Crystal turned up to 11, I couldn't handle it.
It's... it's more heartfelt than a Billy Crystal thing has any right to be. Because it's about his dad. Like, the 700 Sundays is about, like, is the number of Sundays, you know, probably roundabout, that he had with his dad before he died at the age of 15. He talks all about his history with his dad and his history growing up in New York and, like, all that kind of stuff. It's real, real good.
I could see that being...
he does do comedy, obviously, but...
this is like Robin Williams does his best work when he's got some kind of constraints on him.
Yeah. Or when he has his penis out. One of the two.
If you let him go full-on schmaltzy, like, you know, Patch Adams, it's terrible. If you let him go full-on crazy, it's kind of terrible. But, you know, in the right project, he does really good work.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to talk about and praise is the physical comedy that they get up to when they've got, like, the Weekend at Bernie's Dead Wesley.
Yeah, that stuff's real good.
He go, like, the stuff he does with his, like, when they're trying to, like, you know, put their hands together in the middle, like, everyone, and he's just trying to get momentum with his shoulder to flop his arm up there, and his just ragdoll on his neck. It's good. It's good. It's amazing a guy that young, that good looking, can be that good at timing, and I'm sure the direction goes into it, too.
Yeah, he kind of has all the advantages.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of sickening.
Can I just say, kind of leading from there into the raid on the castle, that Dread Pirate Robert scene is fucking terrifying.
So, yeah,
like, it's funny,
you, huh?
But it's also like, oh my god,
can
Andre
you imagine?
The Giant
on fire
charging toward you. Yeah, that's frightening as
shit.
If
you can understand what he's saying, it's terrifying. And if not, it's just some guy
I'm
making...
the Dwayne Apollo.
it's pretty good.
Horrifying.
A Holocaust cloak.
Now,
I also got that. It's not Holocaust like... The original meaning of Holocaust is this fiery destruction. So it's a cloak that's designed to catch fire.
Oh, okay.
That's a thing in this universe.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. They mention it once, and then...
And that's the other thing. That's ridiculous scene. That he just happened to have everything. Like, the wheelbarrow makes sense, but when he pulls the thing, it's like, okay, whatever.
Who cares? But the scale is a little strange in this part of the movie.
How so?
Like, he's 90 feet tall. He's taller than the fucking wall by, like, 200%. At one point, and then he rolls up like Andre the Giant isn't that big. Come on.
Oh. Well, yeah, they did a little bit of perspective, I think.
Yeah, but who cares?
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
You
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. And now, back with more Bald Move.
The other thing, I don't know if you were prepared for how funny it was, but I clearly remember the first time I saw this movie when we got to the impressive clergyman.
The marriage scene.
And
that's the other iconic
one. He opens his mouth and does
yeah.
the mowage. It's hysterically funny because yeah. it's you know, I don't know why we laugh, but scientists tell us we laugh to deal with the stress from like thinking that something is going to happen and something different happens.
Okay.
Like, you know, like if we're all in the Serengeti and we're all monkeys and we think a tiger comes and then out comes
a
porcupine.
Yeah.
Oh, we laugh as a way to get to make our stress response go away because it's not healthy. Jacked up on that much adrenaline, yo.
Sure.
I don't know, but I just know that you get this guy looking like he's going to give the marriage of a lifetime, and he says mowage,
right?
Dweem within a dweem. It's the funniest damn thing.
It's good.
It's not as funny now. I've seen it 50
times. I knew it was
times,
coming, right?
But yeah.
Like, I've seen that scene multiple times. And the other thing you got to think about is Prince Humperdinck employed this guy.
Sure.
He's got to know what's coming, right? So he clearly doesn't mind this ceremony with this guy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's he's
that's
all,
the meta level here.
He's the he goes for an impressive looking.
Yeah,
he's gonna look really good in the wedding photos. it's really gonna enrage the people of Florin when Buttercup gets married. What do you think of Count Rogan as far as movie villains?
He's kind of the right hand man of
He's the six fingered right hand man.
Right. I think he's good. He's a little more serious than everybody in it. He feels like more impressive of a just an actor, you know?
Yeah.
Like everybody else seems to be hamming it up a little bit. He kind of doesn't.
Yeah. What's the guy that plays the Papa Lannister? And is it Charles Dance?
Yeah.
This feels like the Charles Dance role from The Last Action Hero, where he's operating on a level that's different from everybody else.
Okay.
And it works. I get you. Need somebody to kind of... But this guy's got such a pale reptilian thing.
Yeah.
But yes, he's also allowed to be funny, like when, you know, him and Inigo finally confront, and you think they're going to have this big duel, and he gets kind of in his fighting stance and just takes off running.
Yeah, that's good.
It works because he's been, at this point, just like, you know, built up as this big thing.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else do I want to talk about? What did you think about the final scene with Inigo Montoya?
Where he actually fights Six Finger Man.
Did that play like believe? Like he gets a dagger through the gut. He pulls it out. He's able to just with his last vestiges of strength parry the guy's sword into his both shoulders.
I think it's hilarious.
And then he seems to get like invigorated by his revenge.
Right.
And
I'm
able,
not going out like this.
I buy it. I still buy it.
I do too. I buy it in this fairy tale storybook thing.
Okay.
Sure. Totally on board.
All right. And then, like, I just feel like it just all pays off so beautifully.
And at some point, does the guy say, stop saying that? Or does he just continue to say,
yes,
my name is Inigo Montoya, yeah, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. And the chemistry of that battle where the one guy gets weaker as the other guy gets stronger, I think is amazing. And then at the end where he's got him groveling and... He's like, I want my father back, you son of a bitch. He kills him. It's a real crowd pleaser.
I think so. And also the scene where Wesley talks down Prince Humperdinck.
To the pain.
And he describes the pain in great detail to my enjoyment.
I think, but it's also like it's hilarious. They're really walking a fine line between this dialogue working and not. When he's like, you warthog face buffoon, you heaving, vomitous mass.
They are, but it worked for me.
I know,
because
man,
you clearly see his ulterior motive, which is to stall for time,
sure,
right? He's both trying to stall for time and maybe talk himself out of this situation.
Yeah.
But at every minute he can stall, he gets stronger. So I love that dynamic.
And they build it such an epic moment when he does get to his feet and put the sword at the guy, and you're from his point of view.
Yeah.
And then they cut to the prince, and he just like... hilariously rolls over and wets himself.
Uh-huh.
Like he grabs his skirt and just jumps into this, like, I'm ready to be tied up. It's the performances amazing. is what makes this stuff.
We're
at the end of the movie, and I feel like there's a nice little arc with the grandpa where, you know, now Fred Savage wants to know that, you know, because he's invested now,
right?
Wesley and Buttercup have earned this passionate pure kiss,
right? And he's willing to sit through the kissing parts.
And Fezzik, he redeems himself by getting everybody the horses. He's the Andre the Giant guy.
Oh, that's his name. Okay,
yeah, that was another funny physical comedy of Mandy Patinkin throwing him, launching himself bodily against his door, trying desperately to get in, and Fezzik just comes in there and one hand smashes it.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, Robin Hood Men in Tights owes a lot to this movie. A lot. Like, some of the jokes are directly from
this,
it.
I wonder what that movie looks like if Cary Elwes didn't play Wesley.
That, like, and like, there are scenes that are almost straight out of it. Like this window scene where they're jumping down.
Mm.
I mean, they do that essentially with the horses in Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I just wonder, because it's... You know, that movie's better than I guess I built it up in my head when I would go first. Yeah, like I was expecting, like, I'm a big fan of Young Frankenstein, a big fan of, like, everybody. Blazing Saddles. Spaceballs, I think. Spaceballs is another one where it's like, I feel like
Mel Brooks,
God. Not the zombie guy. Yep. Mel Brooks
kind of needed his update, his shtick, and he never did. And
right.
To his great benefit, his shtick has kind of come back into vogue.
Like, I want to say something a little controversial.
Okay.
I think Robin Hood Men in Tights, and certainly Young Frankenstein, I don't think that's controversial, is better than Spaceballs.
I think Spaceballs is okay.
Right.
Like Blazing Saddles, which I just recently watched, Young Frankenstein, and
I think Young Frankenstein is his best work ever.
Have you seen The Producers?
No, I haven't.
I'm not going to spoil it for you, but when you see the play that they actually put on,
is it like a Dayman, Nightman Cometh sort of thing?
Dayman wishes it could hold this thing's jock. And the way they build it up, because you don't really know, like you kind of get an idea of like, you know, what it's supposed to be about. It's supposed to be a shockingly bad thing, but it's just really funny. And if you get a chance to see it on the stage, it's also really, really funny.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I need to see
that. He's kind of had like a second life adapting some of this stuff to, you know, Broadway, which it feels kind of right at home with.
Yeah. I actually, man, now that I think about it, one of my least favorites of Mel Brooks is Spaceballs.
Like, Dead and Loving It's pretty terrible. Dracula spoof with Leslie Nielsen.
Yeah.
Wait, is it Nielsen?
Yeah.
Okay. And I think Robin Hood is like, those are my three bottom movies. Spaceballs, Robin Hood, Men in Tights, and Dead and Loving It. But I have seen that the Robin Hood, Men in Tights recently, and there's some cringe where he tries to do rap, and it's like, man, you're an old Jewish guy. You don't understand this enough to appropriately do a good send-up of it, and it's just so cringy.
It is.
Anyway, how do we get on that thing?
Just the tone of this movie. It's surprisingly, it has heartfelt moments, very serious moments, and comedy. And I think it doesn't do a great job of seamlessly mixing those things, but it does do a good job of
it doesn't feel jarring.
Making them all work.
Yeah.
On their own. It's surprising that this movie works as well as it does, given the dramatic shifts in tone.
Yeah, and I'm kind of obsessed with the idea of what this movie would be, how this movie would play if you removed the conceit of the grandfather and the son and the grandson.
Do a fan edit.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's still narrating it, so you'd have to explain or kind of eliminate the Fred Savage parts of it. But I feel like the ads, like it might even be 50% of the movie. Like it gives it a foundation, a heart that the movie wouldn't have. From the very first scene.
That's
like,
true.
It might earn it, but it gets so much of that. And I think that Fred Savage is like really good as a kid.
Shockingly good.
And he's not being asked to do a lot.
Right.
But like he's just a really cute, smart kid who's appropriately put off by his grandfather reading to him, but not a dick about it.
Right. I felt like he understood.
He's been raised
the jokes.
Right. Yeah.
Like they explained to him, look, you're in this scene and you don't want to hear about the kissing stuff.
Sure.
Your grandfather's kind of annoying you, and you just want to get back to video games.
Right.
Now do it. And
but you're humoring because you love your grandpa. You don't want to hurt his feeling. You're going to humor him.
Right. And it always shocks me when I see a really good kid actor, a young actor, because I just don't expect them to be able to understand the emotions, let alone put them on screen, convey them.
It makes me
want
to see The Wonder Years again.
Yeah.
Because I saw The Wonder Years kind of as I was as old as, and I remember really liking it because it was such a neat thing to see a guy like me, you know, I'm like a 10-year-old boy. It's like, this guy's starring this show, and like I can understand how he feels about his dad. And I didn't get any of the cultural references and his crazy sister who's burning a bra and protesting the Vietnam War and what that did to her father and the relationship between the mom and the dad. Like that stuff, but like,
yeah,
that's why I think it's interesting that people poo-poo like, you know, diversity in Hollywood sometimes, because as a 10-year-old boy, it was powerful to see another 10-year-old boy just like me on the screen, and that engaged with me in a way. So like,
yeah,
that's a powerful way to engage audiences.
No, I think for my money, Wonder Years is one of the best family comedies ever made.
But I couldn't tell you a single plot from it other than like the one that sticks out in my mind.
Winnie Cooper is his main squeeze.
And the whole, I like you, but I don't like you like you. And I remember like,
there's an awkward basement party kissing scene.
Oh, like, Kevin, it's so bad. And when she shows up for the first day of school wearing go-go boots and like blew his, I was like, yeah, I can relate to that too. Yeah, I do. I kind of want to see the Wonder Years again.
All right.
Because I bet he's amazing in it. We have a couple other things to talk about. One thing, the other thing that doesn't work for me in this movie at all is the credits song.
What was the credits song?
It's some kind of overwrought, dramatic opera singing of the theme song.
What is the theme song? I completely ignored the music because
I think you blocked it from your memory because you were having a physical reaction to how bad this was. Is this guy going, what is this endless story? Oh, how am I ever going to stop singing this fucking song?
Andre the Giant with his guitar.
It's terrible.
Playing a country tune. Yeah,
you cannot stop the movie fast enough.
You're right. Now I do remember it. It's fucking horrible.
So Robot K wanted to know if we'd read As You Wish. I'm going to, but I haven't read it yet. And there's another interesting thing that I think was Allison sent in. Allison Wilde. She goes, the other thing that's been eating me, and me too, on my first rewatch in over 10 years is the character of Buttercup. She's the only woman in the movie with more than 5 minutes of screen time. I think the only other one is the garbage witch.
Wait. Which garbage witch?
Which
one shouting in her dream or...
Yeah. I'm not talking about
or
Valerie.
Mel Brooks. Billy Crystal's wife.
No, I'm talking about Valerie. Valerie's cool. I'm talking about the garbage witch.
Garbage witch.
She's given more than 5 minutes of screen time, but doesn't seem to be given much to do with it. This is a particular relevance to me as I have a 4-year-old daughter and watch this with her. I'm trying to be thoughtful about the depictions of women in the media I expose her to, and I found myself cringing at Buttercup for the first time. Not at Robin Wright's performance, which is fine, but at the character herself. In a movie where the vast majority of characters are complex and witty, I found her to be lacking. At least hit the damn R.O.U.S. with a stick, for Christ's sake. Articles on Buttercup run the gamut from comparing her to a character replaceable by a my-size Barbie and one of the most pathetic film characters of all time, she links to an article who just eviscerates poor Buttercup, to a depiction of Buttercup as someone who is in charge at the beginning of the movie and once she experiences the apparent loss of Wesley, makes pragmatic moves and sometimes bold ones, like jumping into the ocean among the screaming eels to escape her captors.
Right.
I love to embrace the later interpretation, but I'm hesitating. I mean, that is a statement that a strong female character in a world ruled entirely by the patriarchy's bravest way to rebel is to try to continually commit suicide.
Here's the problem with analyzing this too much. Okay. Maybe people are not going to like me saying this. A 30-year-old movie.
25-year-old, so, but or it is,
I mean, it's damn near
30,
it's okay. 87, so...
You're right.
I mean, that's almost 30 years, 29
2012
years.
2012 was a minute ago.
It was. 30-year-old movie. B, the setting. The setting of the movie is, you know, medieval sort of, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's that time in our history.
Yeah.
Number three, or C, I can't remember if I use letters or numbers. This is a fairy tale, right? And in fairy tales, women are not portrayed as strong. They always need the male hero to come in and save them. Mm-hmm. That's just kind of how fairy tales were written, because guess when they were written? Way back in the fucking day when that's how everyone viewed women. While I do agree that criticism can certainly be leveled against this movie, I don't know if it's fair to like dock it points for that.
Well, I think the reason you dock it is, as she goes on, because my daughter loves the movie and cheered when the count died. And at the end, I asked her who her favorite person was, and she said Buttercup. I asked her why, and the answer was because she was beautiful. I asked if there is anything else she liked, and it amounted to tiaras and dresses, which didn't help Buttercup's case. But this is coming from a preschooler, so I take it for the grain of salt.
But it's I get your point, and if this was made in 2016, I'd say, no, so what the fuck? But...
It's more of like, I'm trying to think. Like, I don't think she's saying this is a terrible movie and that Rob Reiner should be ashamed of himself. It's more of like, if you're trying to raise a daughter who you want to have a particular value about femininity, mm-hmm. is this, like, at what point, like, you want to show this to your 4 or 5 year old people?
But
because
you can't. You can't.
Because they're at their most impressionable. Whereas, like, if you wait until they're, you know, a 30-something-year-old man, maybe it doesn't. it doesn't
your daughter's
have the full
impact. I mean, your daughter could turn into a 30-something-year-old man. That's fine, but they usually don't. And I just think, like, you got to limit. You got to limit what you want your kids to see if you want them to be exposed to certain things. do it. If not, don't. I mean, maybe this isn't appropriate for a young girl anymore.
Well, I think
it probably never was, but.
And sometimes you just have to relax about that stuff a little bit because, like, I have the same thing with my son, and I'm undermined all the fucking time. Like, I try to teach him about how I think men and women should relate, and then I take him out into the world, and some sales lady comes up and says, you know, she's trying to sell us something in the mall. It's like some kind of beauty product. And I'm like, oh, no, thanks. And she's like, she turns to my son, who's like 6 years old at the time, and says, doesn't your daddy know that the way to keep your mommy happy is to buy her a bunch of things and make her feel? And I'm like,
right.
Get the fuck behind me, Satan. And I'm checking out with him. Like, we decided it was, I think it was Cecily's birthday, and we got her a card and flowers. And the woman checking us out is like, oh, your daddy really knows how to make mommy happy. And I'm like, no, this is like, what the fuck are you trying to teach? I'm trying to tell him that this is not how you, this is the bullshit way you don't interact with the other side. It's going to be subverted. The only thing you can do is consistent in the message you try to teach him.
Right, right.
Which might include, you know, I don't know how you give a 4-year-old a speech on the patriarchy after they watch Princess Bride.
Yep, that's and a tough thing. Maybe if they're Fred Savage, maybe you can. Maybe intelligent enough and emotionally equipped enough to understand it.
And kids are going to be kids. Like, you might have a girly girl.
Sure, sure.
Like, and that's like in a society where women can be anything they want to be. Some of them might choose to be girly girls.
Yeah.
You know, I guess what we all want is the freedom to be the type of person we want to be without society harshing our buzz about it.
Right.
So, I feel for you. I feel for any parent trying to raise a kid in any particular way.
And you can also be a girly girl without being helpless. I mean, there's not... Yes. Those two things aren't mutually exclusive.
Yes.
You can like to do your hair and put makeup on and not be a damsel in distress.
That's true. That's true. There's many fine ways you can split that.
Yeah. It was the 80s, man.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll look back in 30 years and say it was the 2016.
I know, and I can already kind of see where these battle lines are being drawn and how I'm going to be an embarrassing jackass if I listen to my podcast in 30 years. But
of course.
Yeah. The only thing you can do, you can only be as good as you know how to be, I guess.
Yeah. And as long as you continue to try to get better, I think you're doing the right thing.
So, Rob Reiner, you need to make a remake where...
There you go.
Where Wesley is the Dread Pirate Buttercup.
Buttercup.
Yeah. Anyway, I hope you guys liked the treatment we did to the Princess Bride. Any last words you want to say about it?
I mean, I just really want to say fuck the community for making me watch this, making me break my oath to myself.
See, that's the thing. I'm trying to think if there's anything that I have like had a principled stand about not doing when it comes to entertainment. I don't know that there is. Trying to think if there's something that I've sworn that I just would not partake of. I don't know. I usually say my solemn oath for other things, I guess.
Right, right. And you know, this has always been tongue in cheek, but it's been fun to maintain.
Oh, it's been real.
That ridiculous oath, that ridiculous vow.
How were you actually bummed out on some level when this happened? Let me ask you another question. When we were considering the community commissions,
it's bittersweet.
Was it in the back of your mind that, oh God, I'm going to have to, because it's inevitable that I'm going to watch Princess Bride?
No, okay. Absolutely. I thought that would be the first thing commissioned.
Okay.
And I don't know that it wasn't. I wondered if you
went in that with your eyes open.
Yeah, yeah. Especially because we had talked about, you know, how I hadn't seen Princess Bride and all this stuff, and people couldn't believe it, just like everyone else I've ever talked to.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it was coming.
Okay.
It was
coming. But anyway, thanks for all and sundry who commissioned this podcast. We appreciate your support. If you'd like to find out how you can commission your own podcast, as always, go to baldmove.com/shop. Just loaded it up with a bunch of new options for the community commissions. And you can always just, you know, if it's something personal, something a little weird, something a little off the beaten path that you just got to hear us talk about, you can always just go all in on your own. Mm-hmm. But all those options are at baldmove.com/shop. Thanks again. We'll see you next time.